Hello and welcome to Everything In Between, the podcast where a dad and daughter duo delve deep into topics ranging from true crime to paranormal occurrences to urban legends and, well, everything in between. I'm Emma.
I'm the dad.
That's Anish. And I don't know if we're totally taking advantage of all the spare time we have to watch things, because we were just trying to brainstorm like what we've been watching, and we could only come up with like two main things.
Well, I think... It's not that we're not watching. I just think that everybody's kind of now, let's put it this way, 24/7 with your family is a lot.
Yes.
And I guess 24/7 with pretty much anyone can be a lot.
Yeah.
But when it's 24/7 times seven, I'm assuming everyone else, if you are listening, you're probably suffering the same thing. So I think...
This is your escape.
Yeah, well, I think everybody just kind of does their thing, right? Everybody just goes on, watches what they want to watch, hang with their friend, you know, whatever it is. I mean, I don't fault all the school stuff going down, but, you know, we're, I guess, in our second week of self-isolation, or, I mean, it's shelter. I know people keep, technically it's not quarantine because no one's really sick. It's, I guess, self-isolation in that sense. But it's not a lockdown because we're allowed to still go outside. And I know people are sheltering in place and all the terms I feel like people use to either scare or whatever. But basically, you know, we're in our homes, which is what we should be doing. I think we've actually now are taking the next step. Where we're not even grocery shopping and we're just utilizing delivery from our local. You know, we're trying to shop from everybody local if we can.
Right.
I think we're actually going to, for the first time in, again, I don't even know how many days it's been. We're going to probably order out tonight just to help some local businesses. But,
good.
But yeah, I think to your point, it's, we are watching, but everybody's watching on their own. But we did watch a couple things, in the last, week or so. And we're recording it on a Tuesday. I just think that days just go, we don't even know what day it is anymore. But if you're at home and you have, and you're listening, we thank you, because, and if we're helping in any way, that's great. If we're not helping,
maybe we can try to do like little mini episodes, like on our Instagram stories of us just to distract us.
Well, I think
answering questions or something.
I did your Instagram of the books. I thought was really, really cool.
Yes.
I think that's really awesome that you're, because I mean, you're such a voracious reader. So
thank you.
I think you should, anything, you should just let people say, give me a genre.
Yeah.
I can. And what, you know, or something, if you've read something, let me see if I can recommend that kind of thing. But that's good.
I did a bunch of like book recommendations on my Instagram story that are, you can still find them there in my highlights if you go to my Instagram.
Yeah,
little self-promo.
But I think that's cool. That's totally, totally cool.
But we watched this movie on Amazon Prime called Blow the Man Down. That was really good.
Yeah.
Right?
And I think it was released in this last week, and I had seen the trailer, somebody had said, or there was a review saying that it's two, I think the writers and the directors are the same. They're two women.
Hmm.
And they were kind of, I don't know, I guess they were basically, if you're familiar with the Coen brothers, I can't remember. I think you've seen some movies. I'm not sure if you'll remember.
Yeah, we watched Buster Scruggs. That was them, right?
Yes. So they were basically... trying to compare them or their early work to Coen brothers, and the Coen brothers, it's not, I mean, they have this kind of dark humor.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that it was similar. And all I can say is that it's, if I liked it, it's a slow burn. And it's like an almost all female cast, which
it's
is
really
phenomenal.
Well done.
And the, there are some pretty experienced famous actresses in it. And then there's a bunch of newbies, but it's on Amazon. And if you're in, if, especially for New Englanders, it's a New England, crime noir.
Yeah. And it's
story.
Got that whole like fish vibe, fisherman that's vibe.
Right, yeah.
Made you crave chowder while we were watching it. Oh my God,
still am. Thanks for reminding me now, because now...
Well, maybe we can order chowder for
someplace. Yeah, should look. But yeah, that was good. So, recommend. You should if you get a chance.
Yeah. And then we watched... Oh my God. Probably the most shocking, like, just, it was everything on Netflix, docuseries called, it was just The Tiger King.
Yeah, it's got a longer subtitle, but... Oh,
my God.
It was, I think we watched, it was four movies, and I...
Every episode had, like, a whole nother, like, crazy, like, oh, my God, and... It was here. Just, I'm not going to tell you anything except for the fact that a lot of it happens in Florida, and that should just like be enough for you to understand.
People may know it's about the Tiger King is Joe Exotic, and you may have remembered him because he ran for president back in 2016, and
he was on John Oliver. Yeah, actually. Yeah.
So I think he kind of made him famous, but it is a crazy story, and the whole premise is about the animal rescue and
exotic animal rescue.
Exotic animal rescue, as well as I guess
sanctuary
zoo. I don't know how to call it, what you call it, but and then it goes into everything from animal trafficking to
murder,
yeah, abuse, whatever. But it is insane, and
our jaws were dropped throughout the whole thing. Every second we were like, how is this real?
The whole saying of truth is stranger than fiction is
applies
on steroids.
Yeah.
This thing. So I mean, everyone has time, so all I can tell you is I think it was 8 episodes, and they're,
yeah, I didn't even watch all of them, and like,
yeah, that's right, you came in, yeah that's right, it's a and I think they're an hour a piece, but
they're crazy.
Holy hell.
And we usually like binge things like in the evening, right? Like every evening. But like you guys, you watched some of it like at night. And then the next morning you were like, okay, now we have to watch the rest.
Yeah, no, I think we started it when it came out on Friday, and we watched, your mom and I watched the first 3 episodes that evening. And then the next day, when once, you know, everything else was done, you know, for breakfast, whatever else, any other things we had just kind of get out of the way, we just put it on and watched then another the last 5, and I don't want to hype it up too much, but yeah, insane, absolutely insane.
It's very well done. It's definitely check it out. And then while they were watching the first 3 episodes, I was using that like the Netflix party new thing that you can download on Chrome, so you can watch Netflix with your friends virtually, which was really fun. We watched Murder Mystery on Netflix, which is another great movie that I think I already talked about a while ago. But
I know you mentioned it. I can't remember if you...
Yeah, it's the one with Jennifer Aniston and Adam Sandler.
Yeah. Yep.
And it's like, you know, Agatha Christie-esque kind of...
There is actually... I don't want to... There's a new Agatha Christie on Amazon, the Pale Horse. And it looks like an incredible cast that just got released too. On Prime.
I haven't even read that much Agatha Christie, but I would like to.
There's another similar to Netflix Party. I think it's called 2/7 or something, where you can do anything. You can watch.
I've never heard of that.
You can do Disney. I mean, basically, it's a Chrome extension. Oh. But as long as, so you can do Netflix, you can do Amazon, you can do. The only difference though is that you have to create an account. So everybody has to create an account with the website, and then you can set it up, and then basically people log in, and you can lock it. So there's also just open parties, so you can just go and see what people are watching, cool, that kind of thing. But because the reason I was saying that is I know that on Disney Plus, Onward just got released for streaming.
Mm-hmm. And Frozen 2.
Yeah. And then I think you can do iTunes. So if you wanted to watch, if you guys...
Jaws.
Well, not only just Jaws, but I don't know how it works, though. If you rent something... Oh, no, they all have to rent it, though. So it has to be... Yeah, so you have to have access to it. So
everyone has to have access to it. So you can't like all just watch...
Right. No. So if you're going to do Disney Plus, as long as everybody has a Disney Plus account, then they can. It's similar to the way Netflix works. I was going to say, oh, you could then, somebody could rent it, but that doesn't make sense. So that's another way of doing it. But yeah, cool.
Yeah. And then before that, I did a couple other like virtual movie nights. I watched Indiana Jones, which was, we talked about last episode.
That's right. Yeah.
And then I had a virtual tea party as well with my friends.
That's right.
Which was very fun. Two of us played our ukuleles. We drank a lot of tea. And yeah, so would recommend having that experience. It was a lot of fun. But yeah, we're making the most of it.
Yeah, no, it's definitely, I mean, it's different, but it's not hard. Like, I think that's what people need to realize is that we're not being bombed or anything like that.
Yeah, just, but it is easy to get bored fast. Yeah,
but again, you know, it's for the right reasons.
Right.
The last thing I wanted to say is that a good friend of ours has a company called Modern Moose. Modern Moose, and they do all these incredible, they do clocks, they do all wood custom, I don't want to say it's custom, that you can just order whatever you want, but great designs that are made by the owner. His name's, I hope he doesn't mind. Jeez, well, I'm going to do it anyway. His name, Paul Osepic, who's an old friend of mine, but he listened to a couple episodes, but he was listening to the zombie one specifically.
Yes.
And he's talking about maybe doing a giveaway. He'll create a zombie. You should just go to modernmoose.com to check out his work and see everything there. And yes, we own, from Halloween, we own Frankenstein. We own the bat. We have a pumpkin. We have clocks. And he's actually been in a bunch of his work, and the company itself has been in magazines and things like that. He actually had a great deal with some other stores as well. I think I want to say Target, but check it out. And if people are interested, you know, maybe we'll do some kind of giveaway for a zombie based
clock type thing,
or we'll whatever he decides. Yeah. So again, we thank him for that, and yeah, check it out. He's
absolutely
great work. He's also a Wolves fan, just so you know. So we had a lot of back and forth during the soccer season, and he picked the right team. It's well, and for all the right reasons. But anyway, you're doing
an in between.
All right, cool. We have no Liverpool news, so I can't really say anything.
Yep.
But I have a true crime serial killer. Cool. All right, so let's get to it.
All right. So, this week, like I said, it's an in-between. It's got some paranormal to it as well. So it's got a little bit of everything. So I'll start with my sources. Wikipedia, All That's Interesting, Ranker, Atlas Obscura, Ancient Finds, and Weird Towns. So they were all very helpful. And I'm taking you to Ireland.
Okay.
To a small town called Goblin Hill.
Okay.
All right. So.
None of this rings a bell.
I hope you're very excited.
So I have no idea what this is going.
All right. So this story starts in the 14th century with a girl named Brona.
All right.
So Brona was the daughter of a mill worker in a small community before it became a formal town.
Right.
So she was well known by the others in her community, and she would often help them with their errands throughout the days. So she would go to fetch some grain from this person and bring it back to this person. You know, like an errand girl.
Right.
However, she was prone to getting distracted, which I'm sure you're very familiar with.
No, not at all. No.
So
much focus in this house.
Yes, I can tell you're talking about me.
Yeah.
So she would often wander off on her way to the town, I say in quotes, baker or butcher, and she would just sort of collect flowers and weave them into flower crowns, you know? So this led to her being nicknamed Blachin, which means flower child in Gaelic.
All right.
And in some variations of this story, she's her name is given as Blachin instead of Brona. But
okay.
But it's actually Brona. So just to clarify.
Now you know.
Yeah. So one year was a fine summer day, and Brona was recruited by one of her neighbors to retrieve some water from the nearby river. So as usual, on her way there, she got distracted picking flowers and storing them in the water pail as she made her way to the riverbank. When she got there, she sat on the edge of the grass and started braiding her little flower crown, and taking her time.
Mm-hmm.
As the evening crept upon the community, the neighbor had still not received his water.
Okay.
So, irritated by Brona's lateness, he called on her parents, and the three went down to the river together to chide her.
So they're not concerned that she's missing. They just feel like she's on her some, you know, daydreaming escapade.
Yes.
Okay.
So they used like some lanterns to light their way as it was getting dark. And when they got to the river, they spotted the pail by the edge of the water. It had been knocked over and recently too, because the water was still seeping out of it.
All right.
They didn't see Brona at first. And so they started looking around. And eventually one of them saw some fallen petals. And since they knew that, oh, she was making her flower crowns, they thought maybe she went off in this direction and those petals were falling from her crown or whatever.
Okay.
So they followed the petals and they formed a path that led away from the river and towards the hills outside of the town.
Okay.
So they just kept following, lighting their way, got darker and darker. And they came to a halt at the base of one of the hills. And there in front of them was Brona's flower crown, just sort of lying on the ground, but she was nowhere to be found.
All right.
So her parents thought that she might have been spooked by something and tried to run home. So they returned, but she was not there. So they were very distressed, obviously. They have no idea where their daughter is. So they try to go back outside to look, but the neighbor stops them. And he says that since night has fallen now, it's too dangerous and there are things out there that it's just not wise to be out there right now. So just wait till tomorrow.
But we'll just let her stay out in the...
Yeah, we'll just let her... She'll be fine, exactly. But like you
sounds
guys
like
shouldn't.
The coronavirus here, so yeah, don't worry about that person. Just, you know,
yeah, just
we'll take
stay
care
home.
Of ourselves. Right, we'll just take care of ourselves.
Yeah, social distance from your missing daughter. So the parents agreed, though hesitantly, and spent a restless night waiting for the dawn.
Okay.
The next morning, as soon as light had brushed across the land, the parents awoke and ran downstairs to resume their search. Brona's father threw open their front door to find that something lay in wait for them. One of Brona's shoes.
Huh.
The bottom of the shoe was, quote, caked in mud, and curiously, the inside was filled with river water.
Okay.
Whoever had placed the shoe there had done it very carefully so that none of the water would spill. So they'd clearly been like walking kind of slowly to like put the shoe down.
All right.
And then run away. So whatever it was intentional.
Okay.
So seeing this, the parents called a meeting with the rest of the community, informing them of the events and pleading for them to help look for their child.
Right.
And since everyone knew Brona really well, they all agreed, and they searched for weeks, beyond the hills, by the river, like throughout the community, just everywhere, and they could not find her. About a month later, another child went missing, a little boy named Lorcan.
All right.
So another search was formed, but this time they found something.
Mm-hmm.
Brona's body was discovered by the edge of the river, and she was arranged like nicely as if she was asleep.
Okay.
She was deathly pale and barefooted, and her other shoe was placed next to her head,
right.
Still like caked in mud and covered and like filled with river water.
Okay.
But then on the other side of her head was a different shoe. It was one of Lorcan's shoes in the same like manner.
Yep.
So this was very distressing, obviously.
Yeah.
And so they continued to look for the missing Lorcan, but they couldn't find him. And so another month passed. Another child's taken, and it just sort of started repeating this way. So when the third child was discovered, the people of the village decided that they needed to catch whoever was responsible, obviously. And they decided the best way to do this was to catch them in
the
act.
So once a child is missing, they know they'll find the previous child.
Yeah.
Okay.
At this point, that's what they know.
Okay.
But so what they're now trying to do is catch them in the act of kidnapping a child.
Right.
So they haven't found the body, or they've just found the body of the third child,
yep.
And they know that another child's about to go missing. Like it's sort of, it sometimes it's like a...
So sometimes you find the body before the child. Yeah, oh, okay.
But you know that that body is going to be found like in the short window when another child is going to go missing.
Okay, fair enough.
So it's not always like perfectly...
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So they selected a girl as bait for the kidnapper, a young child named Fia.
Okay.
So she was sent to play alone by the river's edge where Brona had been found, while a small group from the community hid in the bushes to watch her.
All right.
So sure enough, as the sun began to set, someone approached her from the direction of the hills. And the hidden group recoiled as they saw who this person, no, creature, was.
Okay.
It was, quote, a short, lean figure with bony features and a pointed nose. Its fingers were long and spindly, armed with even longer nails that sharpened at the ends like claws. The nails were brown with sludge and dirt, and the creature's back was covered in warts.
Okay.
Twig-like horns poked out of its skull, pointing in multiple different directions. And it was difficult to be sure in the fading light, but it looked like its skin was gray.
All right.
So the creature beckoned young Fia, who walked toward it in a kind of like trance.
All right.
So the group in hiding leaped into sight, half of it sort of grabbing the child, the other half trying to chase after the creature.
Right.
It started running towards the hills, and a few of the adults like pursued it.
Yep.
But it was surprisingly fast, and they couldn't catch it. However, they watched as it seemingly melted into one of the hills, gone without a trace.
Okay.
So the group returned to the village, telling their story to the others, who in turn warned their children not to wander off by themselves.
Right.
The community wondered what this creature was, and only one of them had an explanation. Brona's neighbor, who had been part of the ambush. He told the community that the creature was a goblin.
Yeah.
An ancient creature that stole children away when they were alone.
Mm-hmm.
They were used for labor and entertainment, he told them. And goblins enjoyed, quote, devouring their souls when they were done with them.
Lovely.
So lovely. So once they'd been drained of energy, they'd be killed and left for the parents to find later. Okay. The shoes... acted kind of like a warning and a taunt, informing the parents of a stolen child that the young one was now their property. The others were understandably confused by this and asked how he knew. And he told them that he had been stolen as a child. And he had managed to escape the kingdom in the hills.
Decided to like keep this to himself. But...
Well, this was in a different place.
I understand, but I mean... You just think that after the first one,
well,
you'd be like, hey, you know what?
I mean,
maybe it was repressed memories, you know.
Or maybe if you come right out and say, it's goblins, that's a great way for people to be like, okay, old man, something.
Yeah.
Okay. Like, okay.
Fair enough.
So he had moved to this community as a teenager, but as a child, he had lived in like, I don't know, like France or something. I don't know. And he had been kidnapped and escaped. And so he'd hoped that he had put enough distance between him and those goblins, but looks like he stumbled right into a different kingdom almost. Okay. So he was left alone, though, because he was too old now to be of any interest to the goblins, luckily.
Right.
But he did have some forbidden knowledge.
Ah, okay.
So nobody knew how to thwart the goblins. So they tried their best to like kind of protect themselves.
So basically the goblins will stay until their child supply is gone.
Yeah. Okay. And it could be different groups too of goblins. I don't know, but in this community, the goblins have quite a lot of children apparently to choose from.
All right.
So the townspeople built a wall around their community, cutting off the hills and only surrounding a portion of the river so that they could still get some water, but like be protected almost.
Yep.
And so every child was accompanied by an adult at all times.
Mm-hmm.
And a patrol was set up to watch over the town at dusk.
Okay.
So they're doing what they can to try and like make sure that no goblins steal any more children. Yep. Yeah. So it didn't completely work. It succeeded in like slowing down the abductions. They only happened like every couple years instead of, you know, monthly.
But they weren't like coming into homes. They were still the children somehow being.
No, it's themselves. Still somehow like they were just by luck or maybe okay. by distraction.
Spring
of the
break.
Spring break. Yeah. Okay. So the abductions started to slow down to the point where people started not to worry as much anymore, because as generations passed, people started forgetting that it was a real thing that had happened. And so they started being like, oh, this is just a story that you tell your children to scare them into behaving. So the neighbor, he stayed into the town until his death. And he was buried in a small graveyard behind their shabby little church. Though later the church would expand, and it built over the graves. But they moved the gravestones to the back.
But the bodies were still
underneath the church.
Okay.
So as a result, it's not known exactly where the neighbor rests, and we don't actually know which gravestone is his, so we don't know his name.
Right.
So that's kind of sad, but his body is under that church.
Oh, man.
So the community was officially, turned into a town in 1672, and it was named Goblin Hill after that story that had, brought so much terror upon the children.
Yeah.
But that is not the end of the legend.
All right.
So the town grew in size over the years, and the walls were eventually knocked down to give more space.
Mm-hmm.
Though nobody built over the hills, they were kind of turned into like a playground almost. So kids would like go there during the day and play and, you know.
Great.
Yeah, really just sort of like shooting a fish in a barrel.
That's right.
The disappearances kind of stopped for a really long time. Either that or it was just so infrequent that people just didn't really think it was anything other than, oh, this one ran away or this one just sort of died. Just, you know,
yeah,
people weren't too worried.
Sure.
And didn't think that,
we'll just make another.
Yeah, exactly. Like, what else is there to do?
Oh, my God.
So the disappearances started picking up again in the 1850s.
Okay.
And it's not known why it started happening again, like, at this point. Some people think that maybe the goblins were, like, growing impatient or who knows what was going on, but...
Regime change.
Yeah. make goblins great again. So children started disappearing every week or so.
Oh.
Yeah. So this was now, like...
Escalation. Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the bodies would be found by the riverside, arranged nicely with the trademark shoes by their heads... the townspeople organized another patrol and soon found their culprit. On August 12th, 1857, a patrol squad of four men stumbled upon the body of 7-year-old Orla Kelly by the edge of the river.
Mm-hmm.
She was not alone, however. They also spotted the figure of a man bent over her, seemingly like arranging something by her head.
Okay.
So they shouted at him and he fled. But they chased him and quickly caught up with him and tackled him to the ground.
Okay.
This man was 23-year-old Colin O'Sullivan, a local blacksmith.
Okay.
So he was arrested for Orla's murder, though he protested his innocence, claiming that he had just been trying to bring her back to life.
Right.
But the trial was swift.
Mm-hmm.
He was convicted easily. And also the previous murders that had been happening were also pinned on him.
Okay.
And he wasn't able to provide an alibi.
Okay.
And this was because he lived alone.
Right.
And he lived like above his shop and he closed early every evening.
Okay.
And that was around the time that the children would go missing.
Mm-hmm.
So all of this pointed to him being the culprit.
Right.
So they convicted him. On October 4th, 1857, O'Sullivan was executed by hanging and buried near the gallows in an unmarked grave.
Okay.
After that, the abductions stopped completely for like a decade.
Huh.
Maybe because they were like, oh, they got this guy, so I guess maybe we should lay low for a second. I don't know. In the 1870s, a few children would go missing here and there, but again, it had slowed down to what it had been in the previous years before that sort of boom in the 1850s.
Okay.
By by the 1950s, the gallows had been torn down to make room for housing, and almost nothing remained to remind the public of those executed on that spot.
Okay.
In the spring of 1955, a family moved into one of these new houses, Mary and John Brennan and their young daughter, Margaret.
All right.
Margaret was 8 when they moved in and almost immediately started complaining to her parents that she couldn't sleep.
Mm-hmm.
So her bedroom was on the first floor of the house, and she claimed that at night she would hear whispers from outside her window telling her to come outside.
Hmm.
Yeah.
As you do.
She also said that when the whispers started growing louder, she'd feel her blanket, like her comforter, tighten around her as if someone was like tucking her in tightly.
Huh.
Maybe to prevent her from going outside.
Maybe, yeah.
So Mary and John assumed that she was just having nightmares that were resulting from her fear of a new home. But soon, they wouldn't be able to deny the strangeness in the house either.
Okay.
On June 3rd, 1955, Mary and John awoke in the middle of the night to their daughter screaming. They rushed to her room, where they found her window open and Margaret on the floor, tangled in her blankets and sobbing.
Oh, man.
When they asked what had happened, she cried that someone had opened the window and tried to climb in. And so John, quote, rushed to check the window and found that the windowsill had traces of mud on it. The latch had been broken, and it looked as if someone had tried to claw it off.
Oh, wow.
So Margaret went on to say that someone had pushed her out of her bed and wrapped the blanket tightly around her before grabbing her shoulders tightly, which caused her to scream.
Huh.
So for the next week, Mary and John had Margaret sleep in their room.
Right.
Which is on the second floor.
Yeah.
And everything seemed to be fine. And then sometime in the next month, in the middle of the night, John woke up needing a drink of water. So he stumbled downstairs into the kitchen to get himself a glass. And the kitchen in the house is across the hallway from Margaret's room.
Okay.
And the door was open so we could see inside.
Right.
So as he turned on the faucet, he thought he heard something and assumed that Margaret was just talking in her sleep.
Right.
So he turned off the water and listened, trying not to turn around or make a noise so that, like, she wouldn't stir.
Right.
The voice he heard was definitely not hers. It was a man's voice, deep and raspy, and was whispering the same phrase over and over again. It wasn't me.
Huh.
So, terrified.
Yeah.
He ran into Margaret's room, flipping on the night, the light. And at this point, Margaret, again, is sleeping in her bed again. So she's in there. So for a split second, as he flips on the light, he sees the figure of a man standing over Margaret's bed, looking down at her intently, like while he's saying this over and over again. But as soon as the light was on, he disappeared.
Okay.
So this stirred Margaret, obviously, who seemed to have just been sleeping soundly and didn't notice anything.
Right.
So that incident was kind of enough for them. They called their local church to come and bless the house.
Okay.
And so they sent a priest and also brought the family to the church to bless them separately.
Yep.
So while they were there, Margaret, quote, asked one of the priests if he would keep protecting her.
All right.
And so the priest asked what she meant. And she said that when she felt her bed cover tighten those nights with the whispering, she also heard faint church bells. And they were the same church bells that chimed during the family's blessing.
Okay.
So that to me sounds like neighbor.
Yeah.
Yeah. So after the Brennans were confident in their blessings, they returned home for the night. Indeed, the activity did stop for a while.
Okay.
On the morning of July 28th, 1955, maybe that's supposed to be 56, I might have mistyped. John and Mary came downstairs to find Margaret asleep under their kitchen table with a circle of salt drawn around her. When they woke her up, she claimed that she'd heard the whispering again during the night, and another voice had instructed her to spread the salt around her for her protection.
Okay.
So she'd gone to the kitchen and done all that. Later that day, Mary was doing some weeding underneath Margaret's window when she noticed long scratch marks down the side of the house as if something had been trying to, like, claw to get in. So terrified, she and John put out an ad in the paper for anyone to help them.
Right.
So this attracted a lot of mediums and psychics to the house.
Gotcha.
They conducted a couple seances. On one of the seance events, their medium said that she could contact two spirits, but neither of them claimed to be the one like whispering for her to come outside.
Okay.
In fact, she told them that both spirits were trying to protect Margaret from the hills.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Gotcha.
During another seance, a medium claimed to hear church bells and said that she felt an overwhelming sense of safety.
Mm-hmm.
And the family was mystified as to what to do. But after the last medium left, Margaret didn't claim to hear whispering anymore, so they just assumed everything was fine.
Okay.
The house was quiet for 2 years after that. Yeah, and I wrote 1958 too here.
Right,
so
sure. Right.
There we go. Figured it out. So 2 years after that, the activity suddenly resumed and it got a lot worse. In early June of 1958, Margaret started having violent nightmares. She described them to her family, saying that she would, quote, find herself at the edge of the river, being dragged by her feet towards the hills by shadowy figures, while what seemed like children would try to pull her away by the hands in the opposite direction.
Okay.
She also started talking in her sleep, and John and Mary both witnessed her repeating the names Brona, Lorcan, Orla, and others like it over and over.
Huh.
And one time she repeated the phrase, it wasn't you, over and over as well. On top of that, Mary started seeing the apparition of a tall, dark man in the corners of the hallway and in Margaret's room at night. John started hearing the sounds of children running across the floorboards when he was alone. And one time he even saw a girl dart by him into Margaret's room, and he thought it was his daughter, so he went in to, like, yell at her for running around, but there was no one there when he got inside the room.
Hmm.
After a particularly rainy night, the Brennans discovered that all their shoes had somehow been taken outside and filled to the brim with rainwater.
Hmm.
The last straw came in August, late August of that year, on a clear, dark night when the moon was new.
Okay.
John and Mary had started sleeping in Margaret's room to try and catch whatever had been targeting her.
Right.
And they were awoken by their daughter screaming again.
So they're all in the same room, though.
Yeah.
Okay.
So they jumped up to see her halfway out the window, head first, pulling desperately against something on the outside. So they quickly grabbed her and wrestled her back, then recoiled in fear as they saw long, thin claw marks all down her arms.
Huh.
So John grabbed his gun, which he had recently bought, and ran outside to try and find whatever had grabbed Margaret, but nothing was there.
Gotcha.
The next day, the Brennans moved out, and they stayed at a nearby hotel until they could find like a stable place to live.
Right.
The house stayed vacant for a while, and eventually it was just claimed by the town. Some have said that when passing by the house, they've seen the figure of a man in Margaret's old bedroom window. And it is said that the scratches outside the window are still visible, even though the Brennans had tried to paint over them.
Huh.
And also, this is unrelated to the house, but people walking by the river in the afternoon or evening have sometimes seen a girl sitting by the edge of the water making a flower crown.
Oh.
But when they try to talk to her, she vanishes.
Huh.
So that is the story of Goblin Hill.
So the one who said it wasn't me is the 23-year-old?
Yeah, that's what I think.
And then the one who did the bells was the neighbor?
Yeah.
Huh.
I think so.
Well, that's a good one. They should make that into a movie.
Really?
Yeah, that's a good one.
Did you like it?
I did. I mean, I like the whole the backstory to it, too. That's really good.
Because I made it up.
Oh, good for you. That's brilliant.
All of that. I just made that all up.
That is absolutely brilliant. I like that one. Well done. That's awesome.
Whew, I don't think there even is a Goblin Hill in
Ireland. I like it. That was well done.
Thank you.
That is a great story. Absolutely phenomenal story. Well done.
That was so exciting.
Yeah, I liked it. I liked it a lot.
All right.
Good job. Good job. I love it. Nice.
Awesome.
All right, I'm going to do a true crime. Serial killer takes place in South America.
Cool.
I think the reign of terror is from 69 to 1980.
Okay. Oh.
I'm going to butcher a lot of words here, so don't I apologize worry. In advance.
Remember my story before. It's just has to happen.
Okay, so we're going to start with the Quechua people.
Okay.
They're indigenous to Peru, right? And today, most of the Quechua are, as an indigenous group, they're pretty much been, they've intermarried with Spanish colonizers from way back in the day. So the majority of the Peruvian population are this mixed race now compared to, you know,
okay.
the pure indigenous folk. The population today mostly are, I think, Roman Catholic and speak Spanish.
Makes sense.
So there are also pockets of indigenous tribes that have kept to their old ways.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of these are in the mountains of the Andes or that mountain range. And I would say that the Andes mountain range goes through multiple countries. So I would say there are probably others throughout, right? Now, one tribe is the Ayacucho, and this tribe still abides by the laws and rules of their ancestors.
Okay.
And justice for crimes would be served in the same old ways.
Okay.
So unfortunately for one man, a Colombian, he did not know of their old ways or any of their ways, I would believe, because had he would have been different. he had been captured he was captured for attempting to abduct a 9-year-old girl.
Okay.
Now, tribal law dictated that anyone caught for such a crime was to be sentenced to death.
Okay.
So the Ayacucho's process to meet this end was to, one, strip the suspect, the criminal, convicted criminal, naked, then beat the criminal to a point where they're pretty much incapacitated.
Oh my God.
Okay. Then cover them with syrup.
The bugs.
And they got the syrup, I think, just from like the local tree kind of thing, like sap and stuff.
Right.
I forgot to say this. Oh yeah. And then they bury them from the shoulders down. So only their head is above ground.
Oh my God.
Then they get to just kind of watch and wait for him to die, either being devoured by ants or starvation or both. You know, it just depends on the combination. So,
oh my God.
Exactly.
Okay. I used to have this book that was about, like, it was just all about death. I can't remember what it was called. It's somewhere in this house, as are most things that I can't find. But there is this whole page, like, dedicated to torture methods, right? And that was my favorite page. And one of them that they talked about was the honey and the bugs. Like,
did you get this at Scholastic Book Fair or something?
Actually, I think I might have.
Oh, my. All right. Well, then I don't feel as bad. Okay. Fair
enough. But another one of my favorites was the one where they tie you above some bamboo, and the bamboo then grows right through you.
Yeah.
Like, and it's super slow. Oh, that's one of my favorites.
It takes, yeah. It's
okay. And the brazen bull. They roast you alive in a metal bowl. Oh, my God.
Oh, my God. Anyway.
Sorry, continue.
I guess fortune looked upon this man at one point because an American Christian missionary just happened to be passing through, evangelizing, I guess.
Of course.
And noticed this head sticking out of the ground. And somehow convinced the tribe to turn him over to the Peruvian authorities.
Okay.
It was with great reluctance that they did, but they kept him tied. I believe they must have clothed him. And he was, I think he was also bound. I don't know if he was, you know, arms and then tied to his legs kind of thing, but they threw him in the back of the missionary's jeep. Okay. So the missionary then left. But didn't go to police.
Oh, no.
Instead, drove the man to the Colombian border and let him go.
Why?
Well, the man, you know, years later would retell the story, and he would say, and I quote, "I didn't hurt her because she was too old to attract me." What the missionary didn't know was that she had just released one of the most prolific serial killers of South America.
Oh, my God.
His name? Pedro Alonso Lopez.
I don't know that name.
Better known as the Monster of the Andes.
Oh, I do know that name. Oh, I remember. I think Christine covered this story, and that's why we drink. It's crazy.
So, sources are, well, Wikipedia, but then Thought Co., Biography, all that is interesting, and then True Crime Database. And then I'm going to mention a reporter who actually interviewed him. I don't remember his name here, but I do mention his name later on. And it was basically this interview that exposed all and most of his thoughts, even though, you know, he talked about a whole bunch of other things during, you know, in his captures and in trials and things like that. But this interview was, I think I was trying to paraphrase, and there are just points where I'm like, I'm just going to read it flat out because it was absolutely insane.
Why did she let him go, though?
She's I don't know, she believed in redemption? I don't know. So, to the crime timeline.
Crime timeline!
Pedro Alonso Lopez was born on October 8th, 1948 in Colombia, in a very small village. He was the seventh of 13 children.
Oh my God.
His mother was a sex worker, and she kind of kept her children in line with violence. So corporal punishment, whatever it was. And the other thing is, so, I mean, and again, I'm not trying to justify any of this. I'm just trying to explain and put you in the time. But Pedro was living in this abusive home, but the country itself was going through this massive civil war. Mm-hmm. And his father actually was fighting and was killed during the Civil War. So even in the streets, there was
violence everywhere,
all around. Right, exactly. So that was just his world. And like I said, it didn't just stop once he went indoors. He dealt with it from his mother. Now, by the age of 8, he was caught sexually abusing his younger sister.
Oh my God.
His mother caught him, I guess, and basically took him to the outskirts of that town and just left him and then went home. Like, you're done.
Oh, at 8 years old?
At 8. Now, he did find his way back home. So this time, his mother said, okay, this has got, you know, it's like one of those things where you take the porcupine, you got to, like, travel a river or two rivers so that they can't get their scent to come back. So what she did, instead of traveling multiple rivers, she took on a bus. And they went to Bogota, the capital of Colombia,
which
was 200 miles away from this town.
Wow.
And then dropped them off and then returned home.
What the hell?
So I think, again, at 8. So he then became part of many homeless children. And again, some of these were not just parents dropping them off, but I think from the Civil War and all these other things. And he ended, there was a name for this group of homeless children. Like, I can't remember it, but then he started getting into more of the seedy underworld of joining gangs. Again, he's still, I don't know, maybe 9 now, and he's in the part of this gang. And he started to smoke, they call it basuco, which is an impure form of cocaine. So now he's already addicted to drugs.
And he's still 8?
He's still in single digits.
Oh my God.
Now, at some point, he was befriended by a stranger who offered him a bed and food to get him back on his feet.
Oh boy.
But instead, the stranger took him to an abandoned building and sexually assaulted him.
Oh.
And I think it was not once, but he was being held there captive.
Oh my God.
But he escaped at some point, and he then left town just to panhandle in some other area of Colombia. By the age of 10, an elderly American couple tried to help him.
Okay.
And they fed, they clothed him, and they actually enrolled him into a school for orphans. And again, I don't know if these were missionaries or whatever, but and for the next couple of years, he was stable.
Good.
Trying to figure out life and getting education. But by the age of 12, he then was molested by a teacher.
No.
And again, he then would run away and then just became paranoid to any adult around him. So he's back on the streets now. And to survive, he's starting to commit petty robberies, you know, pickpocketing, things like that, stealing food from markets and things like that. But he's surviving. Mm-hmm. And as he gets older, he starts to up his game into stealing cars, which is incredibly lucrative. So he's stealing them, getting them to chop shops. And, wow. You know, I guess, I don't know if it's supporting his drug habit or whatever it may be, but he's definitely doing better than just being homeless on the street.
Right.
Now, at some point, his luck runs out. He steals the wrong car, or I don't know what happens, but he gets caught,
right.
Arrested, captured, sent to jail.
Okay.
Now in jail, he gets pretty much just gang raped by four
inmates. Oh my God.
And like I said, there's like interviews and things like that. He would say at that point, something just broke. The trigger was pulled forever, or the fuse was completely, you know, lit to the end. Whatever, all the cliches. He was done. Like, this is it. I'm no longer going to be the victim. I am going to take matters into my own hands. And he also internalized that it was his mother that caused all of this to happen to him. And the hatred towards women just went from there. So it's really his mother, but somehow he projected that to women.
He can be angry at his mother. I think that's fair. But all women is kind of a stretch.
Yeah. And he said, again, I'm not sure if this was in the interview or if this was through trial, that his plan was to take vengeance upon women whenever he could. Now, after this had happened, he then, again, he had turned violent. He found those men and he ended up killing three of them with some makeshift shiv of some sort. And he was amazed how easy it was for him to kill these people and how it didn't faze him. No remorse, nothing. It was the right thing to do, that he was doing. Now, I don't know how long his original sentence was, but he got 2 more years added for killing these people. And the reason it was only 2 is because they believed it was self-defense because he was...
I think that's fair.
Right, assaulted. So, in 1969, he is finally released from prison. Okay. And the first thought in his mind was, right, time to kill women.
Oh my God. I mean, he
there is a part of that interview is just that, you know, I'm out. I should do what's going to make me.
No, you should go to therapy.
Yeah. Well, that wasn't the case. And for some reason, his victim was, or his ideal victim, I should say, were young girls between the ages of 9 and 12.
Oh my God.
And he focused on those with indigenous backgrounds, or, you know, purely indigenous tribes, mainly because they were kind of second class to begin with.
Wow.
Most people, like,
people wouldn't notice.
Just wouldn't, or care.
Or care.
Right. So he ends up going to Peru. So he gets out of Colombia and is focusing all his vengeance in his world there. So the MO of how he found these girls, he would just go to markets. And again, I think that was partly because when he grew up, that's where his mother picked up her clients. So he was just familiar with markets and he could just kind of hide in the mass of people, right? He didn't look out of place or anything like that. And that's where he would just look for children by themselves or whatever it is and then befriend them in some way. And what he would do is he would lure them to hideaways that he had already set up where he had pre-dug graves.
Oh.
Then he would rape them and then strangle them.
Oh my God.
And what was really, I mean, not that this is already disgusting as it is, but what what he would do though was sometimes he would have graves, sometimes he just kind of had a shallow pit.
Mm-hmm.
But he would stay there with the bodies or return with the bodies and then start posing them to have conversations.
Ew.
Tea, like things like that. That was he would do. And then when he finally got bored with the crowd he would have, then it was time to go get more.
Oh my God.
So he would be in an area for some time, right? This isn't, I'm going to just go bang, I'm in one village, the next village, the next village.
Right.
So these villages would report missing girls, right? It wasn't as if they were just saying anything, but police didn't believe that they were actually missing or dead. Well, I shouldn't say missing, they were dead or anything, that or anything bad.
Like, oh, they're just homicide runaways almost?
Well, no, he just thought that they were just dealing with sex trafficking. So, you know.
Oh, my God.
The thought that it was a serial killer was so far from their minds. No, no, they were just probably being sold to some type of slavery.
Oh, my God.
So, as he got to a point where he believed that maybe, I don't know, maybe when the whiff got out that the police were involved, he would move on to someplace else. So it was in 78 where he found himself at the mercy of the, you know, Ayacucho tribe and surprisingly saved by this missionary, right? So after escaping death, right,
mm-hmm.
he was kind of like, well, should I revisit, which maybe I should be rethinking my life choices? No. Nope. He's like, Peru's probably not the best place for me.
Oh, my God.
Let's go back. I'm going to go back to Colombia and... and then figure out my next move. Now, he gets to Colombia, does his thing, kills more girls. But then he's like, you know, I think Ecuador, that's where I should go. Ecuador is for me.
Is he like throwing darts at a map or something? Like,
I have no idea. And again, I don't know if this was heat, this, that, or whatever it was. But he ends up going on the run again. And in 79, more girls are missing. And no one is connecting the dots, right? No mm-hmm. flags are being raised. And while he's in Ecuador, you know, he's definitely the hunger, it's just out of control, right? He's almost every night he's stalking one way or the other. So he's now near this town of Ambato, Ecuador, and it's during the rainy season and flooding is taking place. And because of this crazy flood, and the four bodies get washed up, four of young girls get washed up.
Oh, man.
On a riverbank. And that immediately, all these tribes or all these people who were saying that our kids were missing, now the police are like, oh, we have bodies here. This is something more than, right?
Glad that they're finally coming around.
And even worse with the police, the horror of what they found just kind of stepped it up. Three of the four girls were strangled with such force that their eyeballs had popped out.
Ew.
Yeah.
Oh, I can't do eyeball stuff. Oh my God.
The fourth girl, her eyes actually were frozen open. And they said that her face was frozen with fear that it was the last moment. So that in itself caused basically, I don't want to say a manhunt, but everybody was hypervigilant to the point where they're now going down to all villages, notifying them to be wary that there's this killer on the loose. Now, I don't think they knew anything about what's going on or had happened in Peru, nor in Colombia.
Right.
But there are now multiple tribes talking about multiple children missing in this area.
Okay, so they're starting to put it together.
Yes, and they believe it's the one. Now, they haven't found any other bodies, though, just these four. So Lopez moved on, of course, because I don't know if he actually even knew that these bodies had washed up or anything like that. But on March 9th of 1980, so basically he's now had a year in Ecuador.
Right.
He attempts to abduct a 12-year-old girl from this local market.
Oh, boy.
What he didn't know was that the 12-year-old worked for her mother at the market. So her mother was at the market.
Oh my God.
And she actually sees her leaving with this man, mm-hmm. which panics her. So she starts to get other
people to
be like, there's this, my daughter, let's go. So this crowd of townspeople start to, I don't even know if they were chasing, because it didn't seem like they said that he was on the run. They just
follow
him and go to find him. And they finally corner him, and it's a mob. And police are notified, and it's one of those things where he is so happy to see police because he doesn't know what's going to happen to himself. Now, I don't know if any
sort other... Sort of like with Richard Ramirez, where like there was a mob chasing him and...
Yeah, and what I didn't read, though, was I didn't know if there had already been other missing children in this area yet. Yeah. So it could have been to the point where they were ready to just rip him to shreds.
Right.
So the police capture him, right, mm-hmm. bring him back to jail, but they know, like, there's no ID. He's not cooperative. So they are just basically have him there for, I think, almost a week and know nothing more.
No.
They don't know if he's... Like, again, they know about the killings, but again, there's no evidence because she was survived. They search that area. They don't find anything else. So while he's in jail, the police plant a priest and put him in, you know, as a criminal and put him in the cell. That priest ends up spending 27 days.
Oh, my God.
With Lopez, just trying to break him to get him to find out who he is. And as they go through and find out, just kind of, again, they don't think they have a mass murderer on their hands, right? They just want to know, like, who are you and why were you trying to abduct this 12-year-old? And that priest said that, you know, as it went on, he was kind of getting a little worried because he just wasn't sure if this guy was, like, a killer anyway, and was he going to wake up one day dead? But by over those 27 days, Lopez starts to confess about murders. And by the end of those 27 days, he confessed to murdering 110 girls.
Oh, my God.
Later admitting 240. They believed he was killing between 2 to 3 girls a week.
Oh, my God.
Now, the officers were completely like, yeah, whatever. That's, you're just now a crazy lunatic. But Lopez is like, yeah, no. I can show you where their bodies are.
All
and
of
he
them.
Ends up leading them to 53 bodies, not Jesus including the other four that are, you know, out there.
That's still a lot of bodies.
Then he would confess to other killings. He confessed to over 100 in Peru and over 100 in Ecuador.
Oh, my God.
I mean, Colombia, sorry, because he's in Ecuador.
Right.
So the authorities now are relaying this information to these other countries, but refuse to extradite him because they want to get him for... the murders first in Ecuador, and then once he serves his time, whatever, then they can deal with him in another place. So he ends up being charged for the 110 girls, you know, based on his confession, even though they only found the bodies of 53.
Right.
And the head prosecutor, or not the prosecutor, maybe that was the police or whatever, just like, look, he got us to 53. I'm going to believe that there were more, so let's do it.
Yeah.
On January 25th, 1983, he was convicted on all charges, and he was sentenced to life imprisonment, which carries a maximum of...
Oh, no. Is it like
20 years?
No!
That's the law in Ecuador. And I think maybe it's 25 now. So they
put... But then he also has to face the extradition for the other ones.
Right.
Yeah.
So he's put in solitary confinement because...
Everyone
immediately
wants to kill him.
Right. There's a 25K bounty already on his head.
Wow.
Right. So... he's in jail by himself. Everything's that way. So that's 1980.
Mm-hmm.
He would be 2000 would be his release. In 1992, his sentence is kind of, you know, coming to an end because he's a model prisoner. So
no.
Now they're like, well, we can get him off for good behavior.
No.
So he's impending release, right?
Oh, my God.
This gets out. Right. So now everybody wants to interview him. And the warden of the prison, I don't know if this was political aspirations or whatever, he was all for it as well.
Oh,
but
my God.
Lopez is like, I'm not meeting with anyone. You know, there's, you know, I'm out. I'm getting out of here. Over the time in that end, he finally says, you know what? I will do an interview, but I have one condition. So this reporter, Ron Leitner, somehow I don't know what the communication was, but enough for Lopez to say, like, okay, this guy I'm happy to meet with, but again, I have a condition.
Oh, God.
So they're ready to do the condition, and I'll tell you in a second what it is.
Oh, God.
But the reporter's there, so because basically it's like, the condition happens, I'm now going to speak. He told the warden that it had been 12 years since he had touched, put hands on a woman, not to kill, like just any physical contact with a woman. And he said he would only do that interview if he could touch the warden's daughter. The warden agrees.
What?
To this. Okay.
Who? What kind of father?
Okay, so help. I will say that the woman was 23. Okay.
Still.
Just saying. Now I'm gonna. This is. I'm just gonna. This is. I'm. Quote. I'm not because I couldn't put it in any ways. With the guards keeping their guns on Lopez through the bars, he was permitted his request. The young woman held out her hands, and the monster carefully touched her wrists with the tips of his fingers. And Leitner noticed how big and strong his hands were.
Oh my God.
Abnormally so. He then released her and agreed to talk to Leitner, telling him at, oh, she was 26. At 26, the warden's daughter was too old to interest him.
Oh so, my God.
Now they start talking as if they're just chums, right? He starts talking about his childhood. He admitted that he had witnessed acts of prostitution while growing up and had and that had a disturbing effect on his psyche. He said, I lost my innocence at age 8, so I decided to do the same as to many young girls as I could.
What the fuck?
He said that by 78, he had killed over 100 people in Peru and had the Ayacucho tribe done, then, you know, they were doing the right thing, and he just said, he was amazed that God sent this person to save him as if he was doing the right thing. Then he goes on and says, when he moved back to Colombia and then to Ecuador, he began to kill about 3 girls a week. And then he told Leitner, and I quote, I like the girls in Ecuador. They are more gentle and trusting, more innocent.
Oh my God.
They are not as suspicious of strangers as Colombian girls.
Oh my God.
And then by his estimate, he had killed, I think I said this before, 110 girls in Peru, 110 in Colombia, and over 100 in Ecuador. Now, he never killed any of his victims at night because he wanted to watch their last moments during daylight.
So this, ew!
Okay. And this is another quote. It would have been wasted in the dark. I had to watch them by daylight, he explained. He said it would take 5 to 15 minutes for the girls to die and claimed, I was very considerate. I would spend a long time with them making sure they were dead. Lopez said he would use a mirror to check if they were still breathing or slit their wrists or throats to see if their blood was still pumping. If they somehow survived, he would strangle them again. And now I quote, this is Lopez, sometimes I had to kill them all over again, he admitted. And then they never screamed because they didn't expect anything would happen. They were so innocent.
Oh my God. I don't even know what to say.
So, interview goes down. He says these things. It's published.
Oh my God.
He is released 2 years later.
What the hell?
In 1994.
And then immediately put in jail again.
But he's arrested in that same year for illegal immigration because he's still in Ecuador. Okay? Okay. And then they deport him to Colombia.
Okay.
Right? So now he's immediately charged for a 20-year-old murder and convicted. And at the trial, he's declared insane.
Oh, my God.
So instead of sentencing him to a jail, they put him in a psychiatric hospital.
He never leaves, right?
Now, Colombia never pursued any of the other murders, the ones that he had confessed to and all these other things. And again, I don't think he showed them any bodies, just because he couldn't afford to go to trial.
No.
I mean, again, the country was in turmoil. So, in 1998, this is what, 4 years later, he's declared sane and released on $50 bail.
What?
Yeah. He has certain conditions, you know, parole type things, but he absconds, you know, doesn't comply.
Yeah, duh.
In 2002,
oh my God,
an arrest warrant is issued for Lopez.
Yeah.
Because another murder has occurred and it resembled his MO from the past killings. Yeah. As of today, Lopez's whereabouts are unknown.
Oh my God.
He's 71, maybe 72. Well, he'll be 72 this year. It's out there walking free.
What the hell?
That's right. So the monster of the Andes is probably going to be an urban legend that people will tell.
Yeah. Oh, I feel bad because you're going to have to lower my voice because of my screaming. What in the world? Yeah.
And that's the story of, was it Pedro Alonso Lopez?
Oh my God.
Yeah, well, there you go.
I hope he's dead.
Who knows?
I hope he got like hit by a bus.
Who knows? The if you see the pictures, he just looks like some regular dude. They have a couple pictures of the Ayacucho tribe too, and one of the girls. But I mean, I don't think it has anything, like, just what was one of these articles. But yeah, there you go. So, you know, happy self isolation again.
Oh my God!
All right, lock your doors.
Yeah. Oh my God.
All right, let's finish this up. Let's hear those fun facts.
All right, I only have one fun fact this week. It's about me, kind of.
Okay.
And goblins. So, as you may know, I am a goblin. No. when I was...
You were taken?
Yes, but I escaped. Hey. Okay. Are you calling yourself a goblin?
No. I'm just saying that maybe it's one of those changeling things.
That's fairies. But speaking about fairies, so when I was little, I really, really loved the fairy books by Daisy Meadows.
Yeah.
The Rainbow Magic ones, right? There's like hundreds of them. But the thing was, in those books, the main antagonist is Jack Frost.
Yeah.
And his army of goblins.
Right.
And when I was little, they have like little illustrations in them, like on every other page or so. And when I was little, in one of the books, there was an illustration of a goblin, or I think it was like his shadow or something creeping up on one of the fairies, and it terrified me. It scared me so bad. I couldn't read that book at night unless I read a different one after.
Oh, now I see how the movies work for you. Okay.
It freaked me the hell out, and I just couldn't. So recently I went back and looked at that image.
Yeah.
It is not scary. It's not at all. It's a drawing. It's a cartoon. And so I'm going to see if I can find it so that I can post it when we post this on our Instagram.
Fair enough.
Because it's so, I don't know why it terrified me so much as a kid, but, but that's going to be on our Instagram if anyone wonders what little Emma was afraid of. So yeah, it didn't stop me from reading those books over and over and over again. But that's my fun fact.
I can see that. I could. Yeah. Now I understand why I had lights on all the time.
Oh, I have vivid memories of me like keeping the lights on as I went to put it back in.
Like
my
yesterday,
bookcase.
Right? Okay. Anyway. All right.
Are you done?
24/7.
Oh my God.
Okay.
Anyway, why don't we jump into the other things?
Yes.
So if you have your own fun facts that you want to send, for example, if you were terrified by anything as a child that we should know about, send that to our Gmail, which is everythinginpodcast@gmail.com. You can also submit that to our website, which is everythingpodcast.weebly.com. If you have story suggestions or stories that you've experienced, like if you've ever been kidnapped by goblins, definitely send that there. We would love to read it and maybe share it on our podcast. We are on social media. Our Instagram is @everythinginpodcast. Our Twitter is @between_podcast. And we have a Facebook group and page, both by the name of Everything In Between Podcast. We post when new episodes come out. You'll see possibly that drawing that scared me so much as a child, as a wee child. So you'll see all of that. And if you are listening on a platform that allows you to do so, please rate, review, and subscribe. If you don't, the goblins will get you. So I think it's just in your best interest to do so. This is not out of my own self-need for validation. This is all on you. So do that. And we give sort of song titles to each of our episodes that represent our stories every week. And we've compiled all of those songs in a Spotify playlist, which you can find at the Soundtrack In Between on Spotify. So go listen to that. It's a good good distraction from the world. Lots of good songs, good mix. And I think that's all we have to say.
Yeah. So hopefully there won't be any shining moments before our next episode.
Yeah. So next time it's just me or it's just you.
I'm pretty sure it'll just be me. So,
okay.
Cause you know, the lights are on with the, all right. So we'll till next week, huh?
Till next week.
All right.
Bye.
Bye.